If you were in San Francisco this weekend, you might have run into a sea of pink. That sadly doesn't mean that the women's peace organization Code Pink has suddenly gained a massive membership. It means the Avon Walk was in town. It's a feel-good event, empowering cancer survivors and raising huge amounts of money for organizations like San Francisco General Hospital and the Women's Cancer Resource Center.
If you are a breast cancer survivor, raise your hands high above your head. Are you ready to walk?
The annual event's Facebook page proclaims San Francisco crushed breast cancer by raising an impressive $4.4 million for research, education, and patient services. We did it, and we'll keep on doing it until we eradicate breast cancer from the planet. Maybe, maybe not, said the late breast cancer activist Barbara Brenner. She was one of the loudest voices for radical change in the way we look at breast cancer and health care for nearly 20 years as executive director of Breast Cancer Action. Under her leadership, the group became known as the Bad Girls of Breast Cancer because of their confrontational style vis-a-vis the cancer establishment. Barbara died in 2013 at age 61 of the neurodegenerative disease ALS after surviving two bouts of breast cancer. The University of Minnesota Press has just released a book of Barbara's writings as well as a few pieces about her. Entitled So Much to Be Done, the book is edited by Barbara Schoholm, a founder of the feminist Seal Press, and contains an afterword by the well-known memoirist Anne Lamott. Joining me now to talk about this new work and the importance of Brenner's writing is her longtime life partner, Susie Lampert, and Angela Wall, former communications director at Breast Cancer Action. Welcome to Women's Magazine, both of you.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Angela, what was so important about Barbara Brenner?
Oh, she was a incredibly charismatic woman. She had this capacity to focus in on the truth of the issues minus the BS and cut through the BS. And in an issue, or as Barbara would term it, the health crisis, the public health crisis of breast cancer in its epidemic levels, she focused very much on what she would define the real issues rather than awareness campaigns, and she changed the conversation. I mean, she absolutely shifted the focus from 40 years of awareness and where that hadn't got us to focusing on treatment issues, research, getting women living with breast cancer a seat at the table to actually talk about the issues. She changed the landscape of breast cancer forever.
Susie, you and Barbara met, I think, in the 70s, and you were together for over 30 years. So tell us a bit about her life.
Barbara was born in Baltimore. She left there at the age of 18 to go to Smith College. And when she left Smith, she went to graduate school. She went to law school for a year, having wanted to be a lawyer from the time she was 6 years old. But she decided after about a year that the law had nothing to do with justice, and she left there and went to public policy school at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, which is where I met her. She decided after about a year that, no, public policy wasn't really speaking to her either, and we moved to California. And in 1978, she returned to law school. She had had enough conversations with enough people to conclude that a legal career really could serve social justice issues, which was where her heart was. And she became a lawyer in 1981, and she continued her legal career until about 1993 when she was diagnosed with breast cancer for the first time. After about a year of treatment, she decided that she would rather work on women's health and bringing people together than on arguing in court, and she became a breast cancer activist, and she became the executive director of Breast Cancer Action in 1995.
Growing up in Baltimore in the 50s and 60s, she experienced segregation, saw segregation firsthand, and her mother was involved somewhat in the civil rights movement. She said her mother took her to her first civil rights march when she was 2.
I think when she was 10.
She then also became involved in the movement to stop the Vietnam War. How did her early experience of social justice activism inform her approach to breast cancer?
I guess a quick response to that is completely. When I met her at Princeton in the 70s, she was already doing an internship with the ACLU of New Jersey on prison reform. The social justice lens that she brought to breast cancer activism and breast cancer action meant that she was always looking not only to her own experience, but the experience of all women differently situated. I think somewhere in the book she talks about the difference between seeing health disparities as differences versus inequities. And she always saw them as inequities. And she wanted to know, for example, why there was so much attention to paid to high incidences of breast cancer in Marin County and not in Bayview, Hunters Point, or in Richmond, or in other communities where there were low-income women and women who were not well-served. She wanted to know why there was difference in access to care, and she advocated for better access to care for all women. She wanted to know publicly fund mammograms for poor women, but we couldn't provide care for them once they were diagnosed with breast cancer. And in fact, in California now we do provide care for women who low-income women who have been diagnosed through those mammography programs.
Thanks largely to Breast Cancer Action and their activism.
Yes.
I think because she was a lawyer, maybe she paid especially close attention to imprecise use of words. And that's something that really shows up in some of the articles. Especially, she critiqued the use of language by the cancer industry, which includes both the companies that develop treatments, companies that engage in cause marketing, and also by the cancer establishment, the medical establishment, as well as foundations like Susan G. Komen and Susan Love. And one word that we have already alluded to that seemed to really infuriate her was awareness, and another was prevention. You know, isn't breast cancer prevention good? What was it about how people talked about prevention that she found so objectionable?
Well, at the start, the American Cancer Society and especially the Komen Foundation were using the phrase, early detection is your best prevention. And Barbara pointed out that if you've already detected something, you haven't prevented it. And then they started saying, they modified that to say, early detection is your best protection. But she asked, protection against what? I mean, you still haven't been protected against breast cancer, and you really haven't even been protected against mortality, because while the cancer industry wanted to point out that there was a very high survival rate from breast cancer, Barbara pointed out that that high survival rate was effective only by their definition of 5 years from diagnosis. And if you looked at 10-year and 20-year survival rates, they were much less favorable. Let me point out that Barbara also objected to the use of the term survivor as a way to describe somebody who has had breast cancer because, as she writes in the very first essay in this book, having a breast cancer diagnosis, for one thing, it changes your life forever and in ways that are profound. And once you've been diagnosed with breast cancer, you can never be sure that you're going to live long enough to die of something else.
You know, you mentioned her, you know, precision with language. I mean, she has a piece in here titled Words Matter, and the words are very much tied to, you know, they construct our reality. So they construct the reality of breast cancer. And so to project this sense of surviving something actually wasn't an accurate assessment of the state of the disease and the state of research around the disease because, you know, we are still learning. We don't know enough, you know, in the time that I worked at Breast Cancer Action or was involved with them, you know, for the last 7 to 10 years, you know, it went from, you know, we know that there are potentially 3 types of breast cancer. Recently, we now know there are 10 types. We don't know enough about how they operate, how they work. And as Susie said, you know, the idea that these recurrences happen past the ACS's defined 5-year mark, that talking about being a survivor didn't accurately present the truth about the disease. And she walked this very fine line between trying to recognize that women who had been through a breast cancer diagnosis needed hope, wanted to feel good about themselves and their lives, and her own obligation as an activist to also tell the truth and not sugarcoat, because there was enough sugarcoating going on there, which was misleading and misinforming.
That's Angela Wall. She's the former communications director for Breast Cancer Action. And we're talking about Barbara Brenner and a new book that collects a lot of her work. We're also joined by Susie Lampert, Barbara's longtime partner. Does one of you have a piece that you'd like to read that maybe illustrates the fascination with language and insistence on rigor that we've been talking about?
This is a column she wrote for the Breast Cancer Action newsletter, dated February-March 1998. Words matter. Every once in a while, I'm reminded of some basic principle in community education and organizing. One of these principles was perhaps made more familiar to us by Dr. Zeus's Horton the Elephant, whose mantra was, "I meant what I said, and I said what I meant." Or more succinctly, words matter. I've recently been reminded of why and how much they matter. A day-long meeting of representatives of various California breast cancer organizations began with self-introductions. Three of the people in the room represented different chapters of the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation. One person spoke for all three when she said, "Our mission is to eradicate breast cancer through early detection." I almost fell off my chair trying to make sense of that statement. Eradicate means to eliminate. Detection is the act of discovering. How might discovering cancer eliminate it? The two words eradicate and detection cannot rationally be used together in the same sentence, at least not when breast cancer is the subject of the sentence. To eradicate breast cancer, we will have to prevent it. Prevention is not the same as detection. Not so long ago, groups like Komen Foundation touted mammograms, to date the best available tool for early detection, as your best prevention. While cancer charities have stopped using this phrase, the eradication through early detection message is not very different. The messages have a significant impact. People still think of mammograms as prevention. So many people have heard that the October mantra promoted by Zeneca Corporations, the Center for Diseases Control, and the American Cancer Society, and other cancer charities, that breast cancer found early is almost 100% curable, that there is now a widespread belief that breast cancer can be cured. But what almost 100% curable actually means is that women whose breast cancer is found first on a mammogram have a 92% to 95% chance of being alive, though not necessarily disease-free, 5 years after diagnosis. The difference between this definition and cure, being restored to a normal life expectancy, is vast indeed. How vast can be seen from the 10-year survival rate, 67.1% for women diagnosed in 1984, and the 20-year survival rate, 51.4% for women diagnosed in 1974. And it can also be seen in the terror that invades our lives and those of our loved ones every time a doctor tells us that something seems not quite right and we need some additional diagnosis or test to check for evidence of metastatic breast cancer. So words do matter. They matter because people are far less likely to take action when they believe that a problem has been resolved. People who believe that mammograms prevent breast cancer or that breast cancer detected early can be cured are far less likely to be aggressive about their own health care or highly engaged in the work that needs to be done to end the breast cancer epidemic. Words matter because they can lead to complacency, and complacency will not end this epidemic. So the next time you hear or see the words early detection and prevention or eradication in the same sentence, ask the speaker or writer what he or she means and correct any misinformation. And the next time you notice the words cure and breast cancer together, correct the record. Finding true prevention and a real cure depend on it.
And I think some of what she's talking about when she talks about detection not being prevention or protection is a lack of focus, especially at that time, on the environmental causes of breast cancer, and a tendency to focus, even when people said they were talking about environmental causes, to really focus on individual behaviors, smoking, alcohol use. And I noticed that when I had breast cancer and I was looking at things that, you know, everything that talked about risk factors were pretty much solely focused on things that individuals were thought to have control over, like your weight and drinking and smoking and how much exercise you got. And then in pretty fine print at the bottom, it would say something like 70% of breast cancer, women with breast cancer, have none of these individual risk factors. And some of them are things like not having had a baby before you were 35, which is, you know, arguably
early
something
and,
that you
early
don't
onset
control.
Of menarche.
Some of this led, I think, to the Think Before You Pink campaign, and I wanted to ask what that is. But, Susie, you look like you want to say something.
Well, I was going to tell you about the house party I went to years ago where someone reported having been in the mammography clinic when some 17-year-olds came in because they had heard that mammograms were your best prevention, and they wanted to be sure they didn't get breast cancer, so they were having a mammogram at age 17. It's a logical outcome of that kind of a information or misinformation campaign.
So what was Think Before You Pink? Where did it come from? What is Think Before You Pink? Because it still goes on. Where did it come from?
Think Before You Pink really came out of a reaction to the proliferation of walks and runs to raise money for different causes, but especially pink ribbon causes, breast cancer, and the question about where the money went. Barbara noticed that to do a walk like the Avon Walk, which was a 3-day walk in those days, you had to raise $1,900 or some amount like that and pay for insurance or have insurance that would take care of you if anything happened during the walk. And she wondered where all the money that was raised went. And so she embarked on a campaign that called Think Before You Walk, that evolved into Think Before You Pink, that extended not only to breast cancer walks and runs, but also to any product that had a pink ribbon on it. And it was about following the money. So, for example, American Express had a campaign for a while where they said they would make a contribution for every purchase made with an American Express card. They would send money to the Komen Foundation. Well, it turned out they would send a penny for every transaction, whether your transaction was a $1 transaction, which probably nobody would take a credit card for, or a $10 transaction, or a $5,000 transaction, one penny. And it was only up to a certain amount of money, like maybe, you know, $325,000 during the whole campaign. There was a campaign, I think BCA's first campaign Think Before You Pink effort was identified Eureka vacuum cleaners. And they took an ad out in the New York Times with the tagline, "Who's cleaning up here?" And they found more and more that with any pink ribbon product, sometimes money would go to Komen, sometimes no money would go anywhere. They were just raising awareness. And there was more money being put into the marketing efforts than there was going to any kind of breast cancer anything.
And then some of the money is actually going to breast cancer, but not in the way that people think, because some of it is actually going to corporations that cause breast cancer.
Right. And you know, so much of, you know, Barbara's style and approach to breast cancer activism was taking hold of that thread, that loose thread, and just giving it a little tug. And what she would frequently find is that you gave it a little tug and the whole thing started unraveling. And so around following the money, you know, money was going to awareness campaigns. Well, you know, and it could be no more than, you know, a sticker on a bathroom wall that said, "Be aware of breast cancer." I mean, that constitutes legally an awareness campaign, an education campaign. Following the money led to how much went into the overheads and marketing of these huge kind of mega juggernaut style pink venues that roll into town for the walks and runs. She then started to question the products that actually contain the pink ribbons. What are the ingredients on the ingredients list? Well, lo and behold, here we have carcinogens, you know, known carcinogens and toxins that increase a woman's risk of developing breast cancer. And then it started to kind of, you know, often these are day-to-day products that women particularly are encouraged to use on a day-to-day basis.
Like the what?
Estee Lauder makeup, lipstick products, Avon also, and a lot of these are the typical products that contain or have pink ribbons and participate in the pink ribbon marketing. And then there's the connection usually somewhere along the line to a pharmaceutical company. There was a campaign that Barbara initiated very cleverly called Milking Cancer. It started to look at the manufacturer Eli Lilly that owned the subsidiary Monsanto, which was responsible for manufacturing the bovine growth hormone, RBGH, that is a known contributor to an increased risk of breast cancer. Eli Lilly also manufactured a preventative drug to supposedly help prevent breast cancer. They also were responsible for manufacturing drugs to treat breast cancer. So there we have it, right? They manufacture a product, a chemical that contributes to the disease, a pharmaceutical product that helps prevent the disease, and then something to treat it once you've got it. I mean, what a brilliant economic profit cycle, right? Who wins there? Certainly not women at risk of breast cancer.
One of my favorite pieces in the book is called Waging War, Making Connections. And she wrote that in the fall of 2003 when the U.S. war in Iraq was just about 6 months old. What was the link that she saw between war or U.S. foreign policy in general and the way that we approach cancer in this country?
Maybe I could read you a couple of paragraphs from that essay. She writes, "In both cancer and foreign policy, we never think seriously about the long-term consequences of the interventions we pursue, since short-term results are the only ones we seem to care about. The result is that we expose individuals in the cancer realm and whole societies in the foreign policy arena to interventions that may result in serious adverse effects over the long term, but we rarely stick around long enough to find out what those consequences will be. It's not really surprising that we don't know the long-term consequences of giving powerful chemotherapy drugs to younger and younger women with breast cancer when you consider that we have no idea what will happen to the Iraqi children exposed to depleted uranium from U.S. armaments. In both cancer and foreign policy, we refuse to examine root causes so that preventing cancer or keeping the international situation from developing into a crisis is impossible. In cancer, when we demand prevention, we are offered powerful pills, the long-term consequences of which are unknown. In foreign policy, when we call for an examination of the behavior that might have led to the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, we're told that even posing the question is unpatriotic. In both cancer and current U.S. foreign policy, big business is the driving force, so that news about developments in cancer treatments and advances in American interests abroad are both more likely to be found on the business page than in any other part of the newspaper." And then she goes on to talk about the distinctions between Breast Cancer Action and other organizations that might not make these connections about short-term and long-term consequences.
And that's Susie Lampert talking about her longtime partner, Barbara Brenner, who was the executive director of Breast Cancer Action. We're also joined by Angela Wall, who is the former communications director of Breast Cancer Action. How did you see her thinking change or evolve over time, or did it?
When she was diagnosed with breast cancer initially, she shifted her thinking from being an advocate in the legal realm to being an advocate for women with breast cancer and, in fact, for people with serious illnesses. Over time, she solidified her perspective about social justice and its relationship to health activism by advocating for more available treatments and better access to health care for all women and for all people. After she was diagnosed with ALS in 2010, she continued to be a breast cancer activist, and you can read some of her blog posts in this book that continue to pursue the breast cancer establishment. But she started to consider her own mortality as well, and the healthcare framework that other people had confronted that maybe she hadn't confronted personally when she was a breast cancer advocate exclusively. For example, her experience in a clinical trial. She'd never been in a clinical trial when she had breast cancer, but she was when she had ALS. So she thought more broadly about other healthcare issues besides breast cancer and treatment options. And she started to, of course, confront her own mortality and think about what makes a life meaningful and what made her life meaningful.
You know, and the other thing is, Barbara was a hellraiser. I mean, and there's a part of me that will always believe she was born a hellraiser. You know, she hellraised as a lawyer. And then Breast Cancer Action, you know, was an opportunity for her to put into practice a core kernel of her spirit. Breast Cancer Action is a breast cancer organization, and they were founded along the lines of the kind of radical AIDS organization ACT UP. Members of ACT UP Golden Gate and the Women's Caucus were involved in the founding of Breast Cancer Action. They worked together to initiate some of the early direct actions when members and activists from Breast Cancer Action drove onto the lawns of Genentech to demand compassionate access to Herceptin. And there was this, you know, Barbara loved the fight. And in the office, you know, when we were in the midst of some big controversial showdown, she was on fire. And she was at her smartest, her sharpest, her wittiest. And she would bolt around. It was an old-fashioned office that was just kind of a series of rooms interconnected through doorways. And there would just be, she would be in and out and just, the energy. She was at the height of her selfhood when she was making change, making a difference, fighting the good fight. I don't like to use the fight words because I know Barbara didn't like using the fight word.
Kennedy, who was one of the sort of giants of the early second wave feminist movement, radical feminist movement, used to say, you got to love the struggle.
Yeah, she did. And not just for the sake of the struggle. It was meaningful. It needed to be done. And she happened to be great at it. And so it was her job to do this. It was great to see and contagious.
Let me say one other thing, though, about how her activism maybe didn't change over the course of all those years. And that was her belief that great missions of Breast Cancer Action was to provide information to anyone who needed it. So that went beyond publishing the newsletter that came out at one time 10 times a year, and then I think now it comes out quarterly. But also, anybody who called Breast Cancer Action with a question about treatment options, anyone who had just been diagnosed with breast cancer who might have called, got to talk to Barbara, and she would talk to them and listen to them about what they understood about their disease. She would ask them questions. And I've actually learned this more and more as I've been doing book events and talking to people, listening to people talk about their experience with Barbara, that she would take a call anytime. And even after she was diagnosed with ALS, she would talk to people apparently tirelessly, 2, 3, 4 times, as they tried to figure out what it meant, what their diagnosis meant, and what their treatment options were, and which ones would make sense for them. So it was that blend of passion about the issues, and compassion for people who found themselves in the same situation that she had found herself in 1993, facing a diagnosis of breast cancer, which, as she said, was a life-changing experience.
You know, Barbara really believed, you know, in that adage of knowledge is power, power is knowledge. And so part of her mission and the mission of Breast Cancer Action is to give women the information that will enable them, empower them to make the best decisions for themselves, and that the more information and education you have about the decisions you need to make, the better decision you can make for yourself.
You know, I was just remembering the first time that I interviewed her, and it was about the Avon Walk, which was about to commence in San Francisco. And I was really adamant to do the – it was difficult to schedule the interview, but I was, like, insistent on it because I was dealing with my own breast cancer at that time. I was in treatment. And she said one of my favorite lines that anyone's ever said to me on the air, if shopping could cure breast cancer, we would have cured it by now. But then she asked me about my health, and I don't remember how she knew that I was dealing with breast cancer at the time, but – you know, I really was really moved by that. And I was actually, it was a day that I was very depressed about my health because I think I had just had like my third chemo treatment. And it was like the time when I was the lowest energy, and I had gone for a walk at the marina, and I just could barely walk one block, and I was so depressed. You know, I dragged myself in here to do the interview, and it was so meaningful to me that the person that I was interviewing, who was extremely busy, took that time to, you know, just ask me how I was doing.
The personal really was political for Barbara. I mean, she lived that, I think, on a daily basis.
You're listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. I'm Kate Raphael. We'll take a short break and return to my interview with Angela Wall and Susie Lampert about women's health activist Barbara Brenner, whose work is collected in the new book, So Much to Be Done. Don't go away. So, Susie, I wanted to go back to what you were saying about her being in a clinical trial for ALS, which she hadn't done for breast cancer. And I wondered if you wanted to say a little more about that. She wrote something called That's Why They Call It a Trial. What did she get from that experience?
Well, she got a lot of things. The first was just a reinforcement of what she had always known about clinical trials, which is that we do them. We throw our bodies at medical science, really, in an effort to benefit the people who will come after us. So she explained why we have double-blind trials where nobody knows, neither the provider nor the patient knows whether the patient is getting the drug or the placebo. So there's no bias in reporting outcomes. And that was important to her. She was a firm believer that while compassionate use availability was important to women, to everyone really who was suffering from a disease for which there was no known cure, it was important to have participation in clinical trials so we would see that whether drugs actually help, whether the new drugs actually do better than the existing drugs. But at the same time, Barbara, because she had ALS, was really in a race against time, and she was trying to get a new device, not new on the market, but new for ALS, a diaphragm pacer, which she couldn't get as long as she was on the trial, because the powers that be were afraid that it would confound the results of the trial with respect to her experience. And she stayed on the trial long enough to complete it so that she would be guaranteed to get the drug when the trial was completed. And by that time, she was unable to get the diaphragm pacer. The doctors convinced her that she was unlikely to come through the anesthetic very well. As it turned out, once she got the drug, when the trial was over, she had a very bad experience and went off it almost immediately. But that was the value of the trial, and she understood that.
The book's called So Much to Be Done, The Writings of Breast Cancer Activist Barbara Brenner. Susie, why should someone read this book? What will they get out of it?
What they'll get out of it is really a how-to manual, an instruction manual about how to be a health activist. Not because Barbara says, here's what you have to do, but because she lived that example of looking, taking action. And if I might, I'd like to read you a little bit the piece called Health Activism, Not for the Faint of Heart. This was written in September 2011, about a year after Barbara was diagnosed with ALS. In my lexicon, an activist is someone who is clear about his or her goals and strategic about achieving them. She or he cannot be bought. No amount of money or privilege will change her commitment to her goals. In breast cancer, she wrote, there are many goals that require activism. For example, better detection devices, better treatments, better access to detection and treatment for everyone, uniting and refocusing the research agenda, and fighting breast cancer fatigue brought on by pink ribbon marketing. While some activists will take on more than one of these issues at a time, all will require a lot of effort by a lot of people. In ALS, the issues seem, by contrast, much easier to list. They are, however, no easier to achieve. In fact, I can think of only two at the moment, though I'm relatively speaking new to ALS, so the list may grow. Better treatments and access for everyone affected to the kind of care that will improve the quality of their lives. One of the differences between breast cancer activism and ALS activism is that many people survive breast cancer for a long time, so many people have time and energy to get involved. With ALS, while some people live a long time, the disease is always fatal and always robs people of some physical abilities. It's harder to be an engaged activist, so we do what we can. And then she writes, health activists have to be tough. Because they publicly take principled positions, there are always people who disagree with them and say so, sometimes in not so nice terms. If an activist caves because her positions have been criticized, she's not really an activist. This doesn't mean that activists never change their positions, but it does mean that those changes are the result of changed conditions or developments that compel a shift in position because the old positions don't make sense anymore. And finally, she writes, activists want to make the world better for people. They are committed, tough, and they are not afraid to speak their minds. Being an activist is not for the faint of heart, but the rewards are often great. You meet great people, you learn a great deal, and sometimes, just sometimes, you make a difference in the world. People can read this book with that in that context, seeing how an activist approached her work and her life. But I also want to say that during those ALS years, and there were about 2.5 years between the time Barbara was diagnosed and the time she passed away, some of the people who were reading her blog and reading her Caring Bridge posts, a number of which are in this book, said to me, that's the book, because it was really followed the arc of her consciousness as she dealt with her inevitable death. There's one post from her can and can't list. Every morning she would have to wake up and say, now, what can I still do today that I could do yesterday? And what can I not still do? And there's one of those lists in this book.
It's a very moving and powerful book to read. It's people die in very public places, and they, for the most part, when it's around a disease, they die in a bedroom, a hospital room, a hospice, a very private place. And while Barbara was still able to do that, she talked about the process of dying. She died on her own terms. One of the things that I knew Barbara, but I was still, there was new material that I got from this book. And one of the things that I am forever grateful for about reading this book is this approach to dying. She gave people a window into that process and how to die. There is a responsibility that we all have to pay it forward. And one of the ways that I think people can pay it forward is to read this book and give this book away, pass it on.
The book is So Much to Be Done, The Writings of Breast Cancer Activist Barbara Brenner. It contains an introduction by Rachel Morello Frosch and an afterword by best-selling memoirist Anne Lamott. My guests have been Susie Lampert, Barbara Brenner's life partner, and Angela Wall, former communications director of Breast Cancer Action. While Avon and its supporters were walking through San Francisco this weekend, Breast Cancer Action was in Philadelphia, marching against fracking outside the Democratic National Convention. You can get more information about the book, about breast cancer, about walks and runs, and about what you really can do to help put an end to the epidemic of breast cancer at the Breast Cancer Action website, bcaction.org. This is Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. I'm Kate Raphael.